quite liked that Joy Division pessimism, actually. Rather more than I think I like champagne for breakfast insouciance. The tramps in Piccadilly Gardens were always pretty insouciant by lunchtime anyway, though not often on champers. But I love the fact that Manchester is showing off, something it's always been very good at. In his classic 1950s folk song, Dirty Old Town, Ewan McCall envisioned a dream for his native Salford, a dream that seems to have been realised. We're going to make a good sharp axe, shining steel, tempered in the fire. We'll chop you down like an old dead tree. Dirty old town, dirty old town. Manchester and Salford are still mucky kids at heart, but having been mithered by Mam and had their faces wiped with spittle on some big civic hanky, they've scrubbed up dead smart. Bulgarians think the town of Gabrovo is funny. Pop into a bar in Sofia or Plovdiv and tell them you're on your way to Gabrovo, and the clientele will slap their stocky thighs and spill their plum brandy in mirth. In Germany, they find the city of Emden a hoot. Well, you know what they say about East Frisians. Parisians used to tell jokes about the hopelessly provincial Toulouse, while in the United States, the very mention of Peoria or Oshkosh, hick towns as they are known, is guaranteed to split the collective sides of the David Letterman audience. I come from a hick town. There are 100,000 people there, a third of a million if you count the borough, and at the time of writing, we are the only town in Britain to have a Premiership football team and a Super League rugby side. But we are, eternally, perennially, irredeemably, hick. I only have to tell people in Maidstone or Purfleet where I'm from and they begin to chortle, rolling the name around their mouth like an Uncle Joe's mint ball. Wigan, the Gabrovo, the Emden, the Oshkosh of Britain. I don't mean the above to sound defensive, but I bet it does. I feel about Wigan like I feel about Catholicism, like some do about Hartlepool United or folk music. Being steeped in it, I'm allowed to make fun of it. I can sit around with like-minded friends and laugh about the lack of a decent Thai restaurant in Welly, or the towny beer monsters on King Street, or, for that matter, the flaws in the notions of purgatory or transubstantiation. But woe betide any outsider who rattles our cage. Outsiders making fun of our hometown is fighting talk where I come from. Mind you, everything is fighting talk where I come from. I come from Wigan. You can't argue with the fact that certain northern towns just sound funny. Because our place names reflect our Viking origins, the sounds are often guttural and wild to the gentle ear of the home county's dweller. Into this category, we can put Oswald Twistle, Barnoldswick, Cleckheaton and Heckmondwick, places which actually sound like driving hail on a tin shed or the clacking of ill-fitting false teeth. Others appeal to the eternal schoolboy who sleeps within every one of us. Ramsbottom, Scunthorpe, Grimsby, Goole, Peniston. Wigan, though, isn't that side-splitting a name if you think about it. My town has been a comedy staple for many years purely by virtue of its associations, chiefly poverty, pies and piers. Our associations with poverty stem from a visitor we once had in the 1930s. Eric Blair was a well-to-do southerner, an old Etonian who served in the Imperial Police in India. But his experiences there and among the poor of Paris and London changed him forever. He cast off Eric Blair and became George Orwell, who in the mid-1930s travelled to Wigan at the instigation of the Left Book Club to write about the working class of the depressed North. He lodged in various parts of the town and was appalled at what he saw. He couldn't believe the circumstances people lived in or the vile and dangerous conditions in which they were expected to work. His descriptions of the hovels and slums of Wigan and the conditions of the pits and factories are written with a kind of cold rage that echoes down the years. Orwell was the exact opposite of the modern left-winger, that delicate flower who marches against foreign wars and gets exercised over smoking bans, but won't dirty his hands with anything as grubby or difficult as class and capital. He had little time for what we might call political correctness, multiculturalism or moral relativism. His sympathies lay with those poor bastards at the bottom of the heap. Below the bottom, actually, lying on their stomachs chipping coal in water and blackness, or, when they couldn't do that, wheezing in damp beds in the back streets of Wigan. As he wrote in The Road to Wigan Pier, Orwell knew that it was so much easier to feel yourself a socialist when you were among working-class people. The working-class socialist, like the working-class Catholic, is weak on doctrine, but he has the heart of the matter in him. The profoundest philosophical difference is unimportant compared with saving the 20 million Englishmen whose bones are rotting from malnutrition. The time to argue about them is afterwards. The Left Book Club hated The Road to Wigan Pier. They even tried to prevent publication. Publisher Victor Gallant inserted a foreword distancing himself from Orwell's attack on the intellectual left. Orwell was vilified in the pages of British communist and socialist literature. He didn't care. He was too busy getting shot in the throat in Spain fighting for freedom, an altogether more dangerous assignment. Though he was posh to his bones, Orwell's sympathies always lay with the working class. He had no time for George Bernard Shaw and his ilk, the more water in the beer socialist, as he scornfully called them. He liked a pint and a fag, so he'd be delighted to know that we've named a pub after him. The Orwell stands on the jetties of Wigan Pier, between an old mill that's now a concert hall, and the back streets of Myrie Lane, presumably a swamp once, maybe even when George lodged here. It's an ordinary boozer, really. However, it's always been the most controversial alehouse in town. When it was proposed that Wigan should have a pub named after the man who made us famous, a great many of the town's more clueless council types almost burst their aldermanly waistcoats in a mass harumph. Hadn't he run the town down at every turn, emphasised the emphysema and stressed the squalor, instead of perhaps pointing out the excellent surrounding countryside or the state-of-the-art bandstand in Mains Park? Having never read The Road to Wigan Pier, they had naturally missed its point, an occupational hazard of not reading, listening to, or watching the things you pontificate about. It's a sustained polemic, a tour de force of reportage intended to inflame and anger. It's not a flipping tourist guide. Orwell didn't flinch from telling the leafy shires of southern England just what life in the north was like. But he never sneers. He never mocks. The Road to Wigan Pier is a call to arms, not a hatchet job. Some people have just come here to sneer and mock, though. Charles Jennings' 1995 book, Up North, is essentially an extended, sarcastic diatribe intended, one assumes, to amuse people from Streatham. I found it about as funny as leprosy, but then I'm a northerner, presumably too daltish to appreciate its withering wit. Jennings' book, it seems to me, is exactly what the misinformed think Orwell's is. Lazy, contemptuous hackery from a posh, soft southerner. He considers visiting some other towns with resolutely northern handles, like, of course, Ramsbottom and Oswaldtwistle, but he eventually picks Wigan because Jennings has read half of The Road to Wigan Pier. Mostly, Wigan is a lot of hilly streets with gales blowing down them and lots of beaten-up people, he concludes. You get the picture. And he's wrong. I think he must be thinking of Pendle. I think Jennings, like Wigan's dozier officials, misreads Orwell as a scornful attack on the town. He cites a famous passage about the food on offer at Orwell's lodgings. The meals at the Brookers' house were uniformly disgusting. However tactfully I tried, I could never induce Mr. Brooker to let me cut my own bread and butter. He would hand it to me slice by slice, each slice gripped firmly under that broad, black thumb. For dinner, there were generally those threepenny steak puddings, which are sold ready-made in tins. For supper, there was the pale, flabby Lancashire cheese and biscuits. I have to say that I'm with Orwell on Lancashire cheese, anemic, crumbly, and tasting faintly of soap. The only way my grandmother could get me to eat it was by melting it on sausages. The reason that she was so keen for me to consume the stuff was that she seemed to think not liking it was an act of regional treachery tantamount to wearing a cravat or voting Conservative. Some people, particularly the older generation, get very partisan about northern food. The more disgusting its provenance, the more robust they get in its defence. Take tripe, for instance. Ever had it? Don't. It's absolutely vile. But my grandmother was forever trying to get me to eat it. Corrugated, slimy cow's stomach lining drenched in malt vinegar. Yummo. Handed over with all speed, Gran. But one food, more than any other, has become proudly, humorously emblematic of the North in general, Lancashire particularly, and my hometown of Wigan specifically. There are competing theories as to why Wiganers are known as pie eaters. According to one, we acquired the name not because of our love of the pastry savoury, but from Wigan's abject collapse in the general strike of 1926. Apparently Wiganers took what the managers offered, ate the humble pie being served up, and helped to break the strike, thus gaining the contempt of workers in surrounding areas. The story goes that, in an act of defiance, Wigan folk reclaimed the pie-eating insult and transformed it into a battle standard. Personally, I'm very sceptical of this. I can't find any historical evidence for it, and it all sounds to me suspiciously like a terrible slur put about by Boltonians and jealous St Heliners. The truth, I fancy, is far more prosaic. Wiganers just really, really like pies. Hey, what's not to like? We can reel off the various bakeries and the top marks of this lovely, lardy universe as if they were a mantra. Our enthusiasm for pies has been immortalised in many a joke. What do you call four pies on a stick? A Wigan kebab. Why do meat pies have a hole in the top? So that Wiganers can carry them to parties like a six-pack. My favourite concerns a Bolton man who breathlessly tells his workmate from Wigan about a new lunchtime offer at the local pub. Pie, a pint, and a woman, 80p. The Wiganer seems unimpressed. 80p, repeats his workmate excitedly. Declares the Wiganer warily. Whose pies are they? When I go home for the football and stop off at my mum's for a cup of tea, she always sends me on my way with pies straight from the oven wrapped in tinfoil. Still warm by half-time, my mates, my dad and I fall upon them with gusto as we dissect the first half's events. Wiganers feel, in their hearts, that there is no social occasion that cannot be significantly improved by a pie. But however much we love them, we know that it's these kinds of associations that both define us and somehow restrict us. It's one of those emblems, like whippets and clogs and flat caps, that keep us in our place, a cosy but marginal place, well away from the centres of power and the heart of the culture, a place that is forever 1932. It doesn't help, I guess, that the other foodstuff that Wigan is indissolubly linked with is a powerful ovoid of mentholated treacle, rejoicing in the name of Uncle Joe's mint balls. They come in a bright red tin with a picture of a bibulous, rakish fellow in a top hat, Uncle Joe, one assumes, on the front. The legendary kick was celebrated in Uncle Joe's Mint Balls, a song by the local folky Mike Harding. Uncle Joe's Mint Balls keep you all aglow. Give them to your granny and watch the bugger go. At any given moment, thousands of tins of Uncle Joe's are crisscrossing the skies in the holds and the luggage racks of jet planes en route to tearful, exiled Wiganers in Pensacola, Bogota and Vladivostok. If you didn't know where the Santa's Toffee Works was located, you could find it by smell. It's tucked away on Dawning Street between Wigan Wallgate Station and the Pear Tree Pub, and the whole street is suffused with a heavy, sickly sweet perfume. What's that smell? Asked my friends Anita and Tony on a recent visit to Wigan. It's gorgeous. And I suppose it is, if you're just passing through, or you're 6 years old. But what must it be like to live next door to Uncle Joe? It must get into your washing and drive your dog mad. Anita and Tony are in telly. They wanted to see Wigan because they were developing a project set in the town. The sun was shining as we met at Wigan Northwestern Station. We have two, you see. And I took them for a stroll in what Bill Bryson was truly astounded to find, a handsome and well-maintained town centre. No need to be shocked, Bill. Your predecessor, Celia Fiennes, a travel writer of 1698, found it a pretty market town built of stone and brick. We have lunch at Mr. Chip's of Hallgate. There's a sit-up-and-beg bike advertising the shop propped outside. The ladies have white hats and smile like the sun coming out and call me love. The actual sun does come out, and Tony, Anita and I decide to sit outside at some pavement tables. They have chips, steak pie and gravy. I have another great northern delicacy, the steak pudding, just like George Orwell did. I once asked for one of these in a chip shop in Bermondsey, and the proprietor looked at me as if I was mad. A pudding? A fucking pudding? What, like a Christmas fucking pudding? A steak pudding, as any fool know, is a sort of dome of suet filled with minced beef and gravy. It's sometimes known as a babby's yed, or baby's head, for its resemblance to that soft, vulnerable appendage. Containing an adult male's recommended calories for a week, they are not high on any nutritionist's five-a-day list. But when you really fancy one, nothing else will do. This lunchtime, I really fancy one. We eat with plastic forks in balmy spring sunshine. Across the street, the memorial gardens are a riot of blossom, where, for generations, winos and truants have drunk industrial-strength ciders from bottles the size of U-boats. All is well with the world. Sated and happy, we drive out to Skelmersdale, where I used to earn a part-time lecturer's wages back in the mid-1980s. Because of its brutalist architecture, concrete walkways and houses on stilts, and the defiantly anti-Thatcher culture of the area, we used to call it the People's Republic of Skelmersdale. Skem goes back a long way, though, to the 9th century, when it was settled by a Viking called Skjalmar, hence Skjalmar's Dale. It was long established by the time it featured in the Doomsday Book. Old Skem is how locals now refer to the typical Lancashire pit village, which in the 60s became absorbed within a huge new town built to accommodate the overspill from the Liverpool slum clearances. Sociologically, it's fascinating. The red, ribble, single-decker bus turns a corner just through Up Holland, and suddenly you go from Lancashire into Liverpool, from wild, woolly-back badlands to Scouse street life. Skem sits astride the ghostly M58, Britain's most underused motorway, and the whole town is a fork wound round the spaghetti strands of various bewildering traffic systems. It's the town of 1,000 roundabouts, the largest of which is known as Half Mile Island. There's not a traffic light to be seen. When I worked here, the locals had a mildly politically incorrect joke about the lack of Asian families in the town. Apparently, it was because there were no corners for them to open shops on. Nothing thrived here in the 70s and 80s. When the subsidies ran out, all the major employers left town and abandoned the people to years of poverty, drug abuse and crime. Now, those metaphorical green shoots of optimism can be glimpsed. The shopping concourse, or Connie, has been cleaned up. Most of the shops are open and busy. The indigenous packs of scrawny wild dogs are gone. I've not been back to Skelmersdale for nearly 20 years, and as we begin to negotiate the ramps and slip roads near the town centre, I feel a strange sensation in my chest. I loved it here. Every economic and political cudgel had been used to bring these people to their knees, and they simply would not submit. You threw them out of work, and they responded in a variety of ways. Some of them signed on, went underground, and smoked dope all day listening to Pink Floyd's Medal. Some of them became, shall we say, entrepreneurs in the town's thriving black economy. Others, from 16 to 60, single mums, scallies out of school and car workers thrown on the scrap heap like last year's larder, decided to go back to college, which is where I came in. I can see it ahead of me, the college. Here I spent afternoons talking about Max Weber and Emil Durkheim, sociologists, not Bayern Munich wingbacks, and nights at wild parties in council flats and estate pubs. I was in my early 20s, and most of my students were my age. It's still the most rock and roll job I've ever had. Like I say, I loved it. There's a new receptionist now, and feeling a tad self-conscious, I try and justify being here by asking after some of my old colleagues. Notorious roué Keith Platt is gone, leaving a trail of betting slips behind him. Gareth, the Marxist mathematician, is gone. 2 years ago. Headship somewhere, probably. Lovely Pat, the gentle scouser with the waist-length hair, is gone. All gone. Would I like to leave a number? No, thanks. Time to move on, I think. On the edge of town, unsignposted and shy, is another symbol of the town's spirit. You wouldn't have Skem down as a religious citadel, a place of pilgrimage, a Lourdes, or a Mecca. But it is the British headquarters of a major world religion, one that has contributed a great deal to the town's fortunes and, for its pains, has been left high and dry by its parent church. Followers of Transcendental Meditation, or TM, tend to get chortled at on a regular basis. This is due largely to their belief in something called yogic flying. From what I've seen of it, yogic flying should probably be called really energetic yogic cross-legged jumping. I'm loath to join in the chortling, though. For one thing, some of the chortlers believe some pretty rum stuff of their own, such as virgins having babies you can rise from the dead, or that cutting bits off your baby's genitals tells God that you love them, or something. A spot of low-level flying seems fairly believable and humane by comparison. You pay your spiritual money, and you take your choice from the range of arcane magic on offer, as far as I'm concerned. I arrived in town 5 years after the TMs did, and by then, the trannies, as they were known, had gone from being thought of as freaks to fondly regarded local curiosities. It was rumoured that the good vibes the TMs generated through meditation had brought down the crime rate. More practically, scammers welcomed the cash and the jobs they brought to town. The gym, a business centre, new houses, and most significant of all, a new school. The Maharishi School of the Age of Enlightenment has been the TM's big, unqualified success in the community. 3 years ago, every member of years 10 and 11 won or was runner-up in a national poetry competition. Last year, all the pupils got 10 or more GCSEs at C grade or above, one of a handful of schools in the country to achieve a 100% top pass rate. It ranks consistently in the top 2.5% nationwide in league tables, a ranking that puts Eton and Harrow to shame. Anecdotally, I can add that a friend of mine's daughter, a timid, introverted little girl who was struggling in the local secondaries, has blossomed since attending the TM school. Wags can chuckle at yogic flying, but no one can belittle the achievements of this school, where the kids meditate as part of their daily routine. No one here is worried about knives or truancy. Maybe John Lennon was right. Maybe the Maharishi allegedly did try to put his hand up Mia Farrow's skirt in Rishikesh. So what? Lennon was an old fraud too. He got an airport. The Maharishi gets a really cool, successful school. Half a mile away from the school is the Golden Dome, built the year after I left town, and something the trannies are touchingly proud of. It cost approximately £400,000, was inaugurated on the 19th of March 1988, and is a 10,000 square foot space where between 50 and 100 people start and end each day with a spot of meditation. Yes, there's some yogic flying here, apparently on designated flight paths so that you don't get nasty mid-air collisions. They say it is full of a lively silence. It seems the current Maharishi could do with lightening up a little. In a froth over Tony Blair's role in George Bush's Middle Eastern adventures, he has ordered the cessation of all TM teaching in Britain, describing us as a scorpion nation. This seems harsh, since he's not done the same thing to America itself. I guess the Yankee dollar is stronger than his Eastern principles. Many of Scam's 400-strong TM community, not unreasonably, wonder why their home country has been singled out and the US left alone. Whisper it. But many are simply carrying on as if nothing has happened. Good for them, I say, and good for Scam. I'll come back in another 20 years and see how you're all getting on. By then, I hope to see you all sailing gently over the Conny. Scam Scallies are West Lancastrians, eyes turned to Liverpool and the coast. They think of the whole hinterland of East Lancashire as an undulating moorland, dotted with dark, grimy towns and villages populated by bucolic dolts. Accrington, Burnley, Bolton, Colne, Nelson, Oldham, Ramsbottom, Rochdale, Wigan, a rolling, rhotic mantra of Peter Salis vowels and gently dupable woolly backs. I can't think of a more wool way to travel than a tram, except maybe a pit pony. Today, I'm sitting on a tram en route to just such a town, a real dyed-in-the-wool, woolly-back town, where the people eat unspeakable parts of animals and watch the rain sheet in from the Pennine Hills. My tram is taking me to Bury. Not berry, not the fruit, not what you do with dead people, Bury, as in... Well, anyway, it's a very nice tram, although its proper and rather soulless name is the Metrolink. Bury is the end of the line, a busy town buttressed by low hills. The escalator on the platform is broken, and Harris' staff are having to placate mutinous old ladies with bulging shopping trolleys returning from the fleshpots of Manchester. Quite why they bothered, though, is beyond me. 5 minutes' walk from Bury Station is a shopper's mecca, a retail nirvana rich with exotic bargains, a fabled bazaar, a veritable souk of the north. Come with me to Bury Market. Everyone in the northwest knows of Bury Market. They come from as far north as Barrow and Kendall, and from the southlands of Stafford and Cheshire. They come for Cristiano Ronaldo posters and cheap bottom uplift knickers. They come for spirit levels and shampoo, for batteries and cut price trainers. I saw an elderly man buying an old-fashioned shaving brush, an egg timer, and a quarter of humbugs from two adjoining stalls. Now that's what I call one-stop shopping, Mr. Bluewater. Where Bury Market excels, though, is food. In the new fish market, built on the site of the old NatWest Bank, you can gaze, slightly unnerved, at the dead, sightless eyes of row upon row of sea bass and snapper, mackerel and trout, lying in state on funeral dais of crushed ice and parsley. The stalls are staffed by either blonde girls in full makeup, who you just know are dying to get out of that white coat and into their skimpy glad rags this weekend, or cheery, rubicund men holding up what look like conger eels and joshing in ribald style with housewives. All of them adhere to Marconi's first law of market trade. Cheeriness is proportional to the gruesome nature of the wares being handled. The grislier the fare, the gayer the banter. Feeling a little weak, I decide to have a nice sit-down and a cup of tea at Big Jim's Cafe. It's directly opposite the market barbers, where grim men read in the Daily Mirror and lads in snide tracksuits get their hair cut under pictures of male models. From the Stonewash and the Jason Donovan Barnetts, these pictures have remained unchanged since 1987. Then, running a finger down their collars for stray hair, they go to Big Jim's for a mug of dark, scalding tea, a butty, and the sports pages. Bliss. I feel a bit out of place in Big Jim's, though. My clothes are ever so slightly too smart, and I'm carrying a man bag and a notebook, and I'm the only person in the place not smoking. I wait self-consciously in the queue, and I read the signs behind the counter. One of them, apparently quite seriously, warns the staff against describing a pictured food item as a meat and potato pie. It looks very much like a meat and potato pie to me, but because of its composition, it seemingly can't be described as such for fear of contravening EU takeaway food regulations. It is, in fact, a potato and meat pie and must be announced as such. Heads have rolled at the Ramsbottom branch over this, it seems. I decide to order an oven-bottom muffin, Bury's second greatest contribution to world cuisine. Quite why the oven-bottom should be such a superb point of origin for muffins, I don't know. Strictly speaking, I wouldn't even call them muffins. They're more like flowery, fluffy baps. But whatever the provenance, the people of Bury are fiercely proud and enormously appreciative of them. At Big Jim's, they come with a range of fillings of varying degrees of calorific clout and grease factor, each looking appallingly tasty and artery-furring. I plump, and I feel that's the operative word here, for a breakfast special, an oven-bottom muffin filled with bacon, sausage and egg. Furnished with this, I squeeze onto the corner of a table occupied by a clutch of goths. The place is full, crammed with representatives from every section of Bury's working classes. School kids, pensioners, young mums, burly middle-aged blokes, couples with buggies. I can't help thinking that this isn't how things should be in the middle of a Thursday afternoon, but my glum reverie is suddenly excruciatingly interrupted when I take a bite and a geyser of searingly hot yolk erupts, scalding the roof of my mouth. All attempts at blending into the background are now scuppered as I swear unintelligibly through a cauterized mouth of oven-bottom muffin and incinerated pig. A few people even look up from their Daily Mirrors. Silently weeping, I pretend to have an urgent appointment with a new socket set at the discount hardware stall. Even oven-bottom muffins play second fiddle in Bury's culinary orchestra to the food that made Bury great and that Bury makes great. It is a delicacy that sorts the men from the boys, the north from the south. In Bury, they say, you can still see kids in buggies eating them in their hands like huge, dark ice lollies. The French know it as boudin noir. It's morcilla in Spain, biroldo in Italy, and kashanka in Poland. But we know it as black pudding. to paraphrase Dick Emery, "Ooh, you are awful, but we like you." It crops up in Book 18 of Homer's Odyssey, and in his Iliad, when the Greek general Agamemnon was said to have fed his army on blood and onions, a powerful combination of iron, protein, carbohydrates and sugars. The Roman skill at engineering displayed itself in their terrific aptitude for sausage making. They took the blood and onions recipe, put it into skins, and thus introduced the black pudding all over their empire, with each country developing its own regional variant on the blood sausage. Ours is very akin to the German Blutwurst, and our undisputed capital of the cult of the black pudding is Bury. There are black pudding outlets all over Bury Market. I buy a bag full at an indoor stall that promises Chadwick's original black pudding. The lads on the stall inform me, though, with a touching earnestness and clearly very keen not to take any false credit, that they do not make these famed black puddings. No, they are merely licensed to sell Chadwick's puddings in the indoor market. Chadwick's themselves, the Leonardo da Vinci's of the blood sausage, can be found outside. I don't need to ask directions. I just look for the queue. I had intended to do an interview of sorts with the proprietor, but soon realised that it would be akin to interviewing Pelé mid-dribble or Mozart mid-sonata. Every shred of concentration front of house, presumably somewhere else unspeakable things are happening in huge vats, is taken up serving at breakneck speed the blood-crazed townsfolk of Bury. I slip in line and I quickly learn the lingo. Lean means without those white bits of fat studded through the pudding. Each to their own, of course, but for me, if you're tucking into a membranous bag of congealed animal blood, I reckon it's a bit late to start going on macrobiotic. A two is two puddings linked together. A four, naturally, is four. A six is presumably for parties. I buy two fours of fat and a two of lean for when I next have a waifish supermodel over for full English breakfast. By the time I leave the market, I feel slightly queasy, like a portable abattoir, weighed down with carrion, gore and carnage. But I would leave Bury even more burdened with exotic fare. On the edge of the market is a delicatessen. Not any old delicatessen, though. Maybe the best deli I'd ever seen. It felt like I'd strayed into a proper cafe neon in the back streets of Nicosia, Warsaw or Istanbul. I half expected leathery old fishermen playing with worry beads and sipping tar black coffee or mint tea or ouzo. There was every kind of spicy sausage, from kielbasa to chorizo to braunschweiger. There were glistening honeyed baklavas, rich custardy galaktoboreko, and slices of plum cake that you could put on weight by just looking at. There were cheeses from Cyprus, Bulgarian brandies, and hams from Spain. There were even tubs of schmaltz, the rendered chicken fat that's indispensable to real Jewish cooking, all being snapped up by the cosmopolites of Bury. I had to find some more space in my man bag, I can tell you. Outside the shop, a tanned man in his 50s was diligently and paternally arranging the pavement tables in neat rows. I knew this had to be the proprietor. George Katsouris came to Bury Market from Cyprus 35 years ago and is now a fixture. No, make that a treasure in the town. We sell anything a little ethnic and we sell to anyone and everyone. Lancashire people, people from far away who are homesick, people who are curious. If this deli was in Camden or Brighton, we northerners would never hear the last of it. Smug Sunday broadsheet columnists would be forever telling us how popping down there was part of their Sunday morning routine, how they couldn't knock off their 500 words without some of George's Hungarian poppy seed cake and real Turkish coffee. As it is, it's in Bury, so you'll never read a word about it in the Observer. Maybe that's for the best. I wend my way back to the Metrolink stop via the old railway station, now home to the East Lancashire Steam Railway and one of Bury's top tourist attractions. It looks good from the top of Bank Street steps if you're a train spotter looking for a snap. I was rather distracted by the fact that an old boy in a Bury FC replica shirt fell spectacularly down these steps while I was admiring the view. By his vague yet voluble demeanour and his florid complexion, I guessed that Tommy had spent the afternoon on licensed premises. It's very easy to do that in Bury. There's a pub every few yards, it seems. The North can make no claims on exclusivity where pubs are concerned. Obviously, the Rover's Return might be Britain's most famous pub, but it's surely run a close second by the Queen Vic. No, where the North does stand out is in the matter of the Working Men's Club. The South has clubs, of course, but they're more likely to revolve around golf or tennis or some other sport, or perhaps the services, such as the British Legion, or maybe the Conservative Party. The Working Men's Club is essentially northern in character and image. Odd, because they were started by a southerner. Henry Solly, 1813 to 1903, was born in London, the son of a successful railway mogul. His father wanted him to work in the business too, but Henry, bless him, was conscious of intolerable disorder all around me and an overpowering desire to right all the wrongs in the universe. One of these wrongs, as he saw it, was the widespread wretched and degrading bondage to the public house among the working classes. And out of this grew the invention of the Working Men's Club and Institute Union in 1862. These were dry venues which Solly believed would provide recreation and create an informal teaching situation where more serious matters could gradually be introduced. Eventually, though, under pressure from the working men themselves, who were working up quite a thirst during all this gradual introduction of serious matters and informal teaching, Solly gave in on what became known as the Great Beer Question. After 1865, booze became available in working men's clubs, fortunately for Bernard Manning. Southern in origin, it was the North that embraced these clubs enthusiastically. In fact, they eventually became synonymous with the Northern Night Out, chiefly because of a TV show called the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Social Club. On reflection, the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Social Club was the kind of meta-textual, high-concept, reflexive irony that could have E4 or BBC Three schedulers of today drooling. It simultaneously mocked and celebrated the institution of the Working Men's Club, managing to have its cake and yet eat it with gusto. Actually, it wasn't cake, it was pies. At some point in every show, Colin Crompton, as the morose, flat-capped concert chairman, would clang his bell and announce, "Pies have come!" A moment of fleeting pleasure in what you felt was a bleak night out. But the genius of the show, and I think genius isn't too strong a word, is that while holding up the institution of the Working Man's Club to general ridicule, it simply shoved out an hour's worth of club-style entertainment and got 10 million viewers. As a small and impressionable boy, I quite liked the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Social Club because I was a devotee of Crompton. Resembling a suicidal stand-up in a Samuel Beckett play, he made Archie Rice look like Norman Wisdom. Jowly and hangdog with a disastrous wispy comb-over and a permanently dripping number six, he would deliver material that extracted bitter mirth from the futility of existence and the impossibility of happiness. One of my favourites was his long riff on the grimness of the dying Lancashire seaside resort, Morecambe, where they don't bury the dead, they stand them up in bush shelters. And the town turned out every Wednesday afternoon to watch the bacon slicer. Lovely girl. Chief among the town's attractions were boat trips around Heysham Head. "They don't come back," said Crompton in a tone of nihilistic resignation. "They don't want to." The Wheel Tappers, though, a world of yellowing formica tables, bingo callers and pie and pea suppers, was a very particular and partial picture of clubland. If you had visited Batley Variety Club in the early 70s, you might have thought you'd stepped through a wormhole in space, from a small mining town in Yorkshire to Las Vegas. It was the Broadway of the North, a huge purpose-built club in a Yorkshire mill town, foundation stone laid by the Bachelors, Christmas 1966, that played host in its heyday to stars like Shirley Bassey and Louis Armstrong. They would have been driven down the A653 by proud owner and larger-than-life bingo baron Jimmy Corrigan. Rumour had it that he'd offered Elvis $100,000 for a week at Batley in the late 60s. Colonel Tom Parker replied that $100,000 suited him, but what about Elvis's fee? Corrigan wanted to give people what was, for the time, high-class entertainment at Yorkshire prices. He was forever encouraging the staff to sell the chicken in a basket, as it was about the only source of profit. The halcyon days of Batley and the rest are gone. Ironically, the last successful working men's club in Britain is probably the Phoenix Club in Peter Kay's Phoenix Nights, a comedy about a failing social club enjoyed by people who wouldn't know a full house from a meat raffle. Meat of varying provenances comprises my souvenirs of Bury. Apart from my delicious cosmopolitan haul from Katsouris, no one is terribly impressed. Or hungry, it seems. Now, if I'd gone to a different corner of the market, or perhaps another part of town, and shopped at a different shop, maybe, I'd have come home with another kind of Lancashire delicacy. Smoky dals and fluffy naans, juicy bargees and spicy channas, curries rich with ghee and aromatic with cumin and coriander. I can't help thinking that I'd have been a lot more popular if I had. My mum gave me the first Indian food I'd ever tasted. She worked in a cotton mill alongside many Bangladeshi and Pakistani weavers. And one winter night in the late 70s, she brought home a little gift of some home cooking that a young man had given her as a thank you for some favour. There was a Tupperware container full of a thick yellowish stew, some lumpy little brown dumpling things, and several flatbreads wrapped and rolled in silver foil. Dal, pakora and chapatis, essentially. My mum and dad examined each one with extreme caution, sniffed at the contents and recoiled a little at the warm and pungent spices, having been weaned on starch from which all flavour had been ruthlessly boiled away for fear of poisoning. I sat and ate it all in one go. I grilled the chapatis like toast, not knowing what else to do with them, slathered them with butter and then dipped them in the dal. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven, or, more accurately, wherever Muslim people went. Delighted with how his cooking, or maybe his mum's or his sister's, had been received, he would send me my own Bijou customised takeaways once a week or so. I'm ashamed to say now that because my benefactor's nickname at work was Charlie, he became known in my house as Charlie Chapati. It wasn't meant as a slight, it was said affectionately, if anything, and I was only a kid, but I know how it sounds now, patronising and trivialising. Charlie must have been part of the second, or maybe third wave, of Asian immigrants who'd come to Britain to work in the mills of Lancashire and Yorkshire. Britain's relationship with the subcontinent is everywhere murky and complicated, and the world of textiles has some of the darkest and bloodiest threads running through its warp and weft. Cotton spinning was a technology borrowed from India and then mechanised in Lancashire during the Industrial Revolution. King Cotton and King Coal ruled our lives and kept us shod and housed for 100 years. Every member of my immediate family, including me briefly, worked in one or the other industry. By the 1960s, new technology and the drive to maximise profits meant that Courtaulds and the like wanted to run their mills 24 hours a day. As a kid, I remember excited, apprehensive talk about the new continental shifts. There were 3 a day, 6 a.m. till 2 p.m, 2 p.m. till 10 p.m, and 10 p.m. till 6 a.m. People didn't mind 6-2. Lancashire workers were early risers by nature, and it meant you had most of the day to yourself. 2-10 was less popular, as it seemed to fill the day, but you could make the last hour in the pub or get home to put your feet up for a while, and you did get a nice lie-in. Everyone hated nights, though. Desperate to keep the looms and carding machines throbbing and rattling day and night, the textile barons sent agents to remote Pakistani villages to recruit workers. There was a rich, cruel irony here. A century and a half earlier, Britain had cut off the thumbs of Bengali weavers to maintain Lancashire textiles' competitive edge in British-ruled India. Now we needed both their skills and their willingness to work the graveyard shifts. For their part, the young Pakistani men were largely happy to come. The mills were warm, the money was good. For a while, both communities existed in a state of tolerant scepticism. Elsewhere in the world, though, in grim sweatshops across Asia, women and kids were working longer, harder, and for much, much less. The British textile industry was doomed, particularly since the days of muscular protectionism of British industry were long gone. As the mills declined, entire towns ossified and decayed. All communities were united on the scrap heap where there was little racial discrimination. Asian communities were forced into the local service economy, brothers pooling their savings and setting up shops or curry houses or turning to minicabbing. Across the Pennine Hills, from Oldham, Burnley, Accrington and Blackburn to Bradford and Leeds, the Pakistani and Bangladeshi communities were among Britain's most impoverished. Trouble simmered quietly in the cobbled streets and the run-down estates. Arthur C. Clarke thought that 2001 would be all about hands reaching out across the galaxy and civilizations coming together across unimaginable distances. In fact, the first year of the new millennium showed that human beings haven't really come very far since we were apes bashing away at bones in the desert. The year 2001 wasn't about ingenuity and destiny. It was all about stupidity and horror and man's capacity for slaughtering each other over competing varieties of mumbo-jumbo. In the summer before 9/11, though, Britain had its own lesson in the clash of cultures. After years of decline, neglect and ghettoisation, plus the provocation of the parasitic far right, the North burned. It burned as it had done 20 years before, but then it had been disenfranchised and riot-happy white and Afro-Caribbean youths, the traditional troublemakers. This time, it was the Asians, who for years had kept their heads down and their noses clean, as one young Bangladeshi lad I worked with put it. Not anymore. Bradford burned, Oldham burned, Burnley burned. The pissed-off kids of my old friend Charlie Chapati were mad as hell, and they weren't going to take it anymore. That's one way of looking at it, of course. Others were less inclined to be sociological. Areas of Oldham and Burnley had become no-go areas for whites, they said, and the police turned a blind eye. The blue touch paper was lit when an elderly white war veteran was beaten senseless for straying innocently into a park in a predominantly Asian enclave of Oldham on his way home from a rugby match. Quick as ever to capitalise on misery, fascists came to town. They dressed in good suits these days, but they were as ugly as ever and bent on trouble. Riots blazed across the Pennine towns. Asian youths fought pitched battles with police. Pubs were firebombed. Cars torched. 5 years on, in May 2006, reports on the Milltown riots were published. All the usual suspects were blamed. Deprivation, lack of integration and shared values. Failures were systemic. Problems institutionalised. Lessons had to be learned. On the day the report was published, I took myself, for the first time in many years, to Oldham. Out of the station, there is a distinct lack of any helpful signage. The station also seems to be built on an impenetrable one-way system come flyover that's wreathed in exhaust fumes. There's a selection of subways, non-signposted, all of them looking like a terrific place to get murdered. The town's womenfolk must detest them. Taking my life in my hands, I cross the arterial road, travelling hopefully, as Robert Louis Stevenson would have it, rather than with any firm notion of arriving anywhere. Eventually, I see a sign of sorts. It's a huge, faded insignia painted on a railway bridge, and it reads, "Welcome to Oldham, home of the Tubi Grip Bandage." Towns hereabouts straddle and burrow into the Pennine foothills, and so the streets are often built at calf strength and gradients. I pick a likely-looking one, and I aim up to the crest of what logic dictates must be the centre of town. It's a depressing slog, past shabby shops and a grim-looking nightery called the Niagara, misspelt to chime with Viagra, fantasy bar. The locally famous Coliseum Theatre is now surrounded by a garish clutch of fun pubs and variants of the Poundland cheap shop concept. The Victorian Town Hall, although clearly once an impressive structure, looks as if it hasn't seen a mayoral address or a heated debate about bus routes in years. But there are muscular pillars and imposing steps, and at the top, a blue plaque that reads, "Here, Winston Churchill began his political career." Winnie gave his inaugural acceptance speech on these steps when first elected as a Conservative MP for the town in 1900. If that seems odd for a Lancashire cotton town, well, Oldham has never been as dyed-in-the-wool as you might think. The town's most famous musical son was William Walton, a northerner who spent his whole life disguising every trace of Lancashire in his makeup, dressing in floppy hats and cravats, and writing imperial marches for coronations. He ended up every bit as much the establishment pillar as Winston. They do things their own way in this corner of Lancashire. Eventually, I find a vaguely useful sign. It points to Gallery Oldham, so I take a right at yet another fun pub promising yet more big-screen Sky Sports action and two-for-one offers, and go looking for culture. Gallery Oldham turns out to be pretty marvellous. a classy bit of modernist steel and glass in the midst of tat and run-down Victoriana. It's the only library I've ever come across which seems to have a nightclub inside. It was taking delivery of crates of those flavoured vodka drinks for people who don't like alcohol but want to get utterly trashed and seemed to be called Rude, or possibly 365. A large banner proclaimed, "It's all about house music," which reminded me of those strange lines from the Hokey Cokey about putting your right leg in and your right leg out and that's what it's all about. Is that really what it's all about? Surely there's more to life than that. Walk through the crime and fantasy sections and at the back of Gallery Oldham you can sit on a nice blue IKEA settee and look through a huge display window across the town. You can see the vast old cotton mill that I worked in for a week when Courtaulds were trying, unsuccessfully, to train me as a manager. You can see not far behind it the big whale-backed Pennine Ridges reminding you that Oldham is very nearly hill country. Completing what is essentially modern Oldham in a single sweeping vista, you can also see the grand golden dome of a mosque. That mosque will be frequented, I imagine, by many of the people of Glodick, a predominantly Asian area. When I asked the taxi driver to take me there, I half expected him to blanch as if I'd asked him for Harlem or Watts, so pervasive is all this stuff about racial ghettos. As it was, he just looked a little pissed off and beckoned me in. He was maybe hoping for a fare to Aberdeen. According to the BNP in the Daily Mail, Glodick is one of the notorious no-go areas of Oldham, a sort of Islamabad of the Pennines where white men fear to tread. This May morning, I am one of the few white faces on the street, and though I feel conspicuous, I don't feel unduly nervous. Up north, there's always been the feeling that Oldham and Burnley are much less racially tolerant and integrated than nearby Rochdale, so maybe there are other parts of Glodick where I wouldn't feel safe. But I doubt it. I browse the trays of gulab jamun in a sweet shop, that obscenely sweet syrupy confection that you can feel furring your arteries as you look at it. I opt for a marginally healthier pakora and watch Glodick go by. I notice a few camera crews and young women in smart suits talking earnestly into radio mics. As the report on the Oldham riots of 2001 is out today, the media has come to town, getting their "Today, Glodick is peaceful, but 5 years ago, these streets were the scene of some of the worst rioting in British history as simmering racial tensions erupted in this quiet Lancashire mill town." Pieces done for the 6 o'clock news. For the record, and it'll have to be a pretty vague kind of record, I'm afraid, what did happen 5 years ago is still somewhat murky. An old chap did get horribly, comprehensively battered by a gang of Asian youths, but it's by no means proven that it was a racist attack. Some say that in the ensuing mayhem, an Asian woman was attacked too. What's indisputable is that a mob of Asian youths attacked several pubs in the Glodick area. "There was just a big gang of them," said Paul Barrow, landlord of one. "They all charged in, kicking us, punching us, and then proceeded to attack all my customers with whatever they had in their hand. Stools, bottles, glasses. A firebomb came through the window, causing panic among the regulars, some of whom were elderly ladies." The landlord was quick to add, though, that his clientele included Asians. They were absolutely disgusted. They had to defend themselves like everybody else. The pub, by the way, is called the Live and Let Live. As I nibble my pakora, I watch a smartly dressed Asian man being interviewed by one of the equally presentable young women reporters. She calls him a community leader, which always makes me tremendously suspicious, whatever the community being led. White, black, gay, straight, Asian, Afro-Caribbean, traveller or whatever. Having never seen the job of community leader advertised in a job centre, I assume now it's a euphemism for busybody, a type common to all communities. For some reason they've moved on to the subject of the so-called 7/7 London bombings, and he's trotting out the now obligatory line about the need to understand the root causes of this problem, what makes these young men so desperate that they must blow themselves up. Oddly, I don't seem to recall any such hand-wringing about the motives of the IRA. Maybe I missed it, but I don't remember seeing government spokesmen talking of the need to understand what makes these young working-class Catholics blow up soldiers. In fact, I distinctly recall that stringing the bastards up was the only language they would understand. How kindly and thoughtful we have become. I leave Glodick and I pop back into the library to see if the riots and their aftermath are being addressed here in any significant sense. They aren't, which perhaps isn't surprising. It's a tough subject to turn into an attractive exhibition or snappy theme week. Oldham, Lancashire's premier racial trouble spot. Try our fun quiz and treasure hunt. I sit in the blue IKEA chair and I look out across the town again. Beyond the houses and chimneys and mosques, the Pennine Moors rise under what is now a glowering sky. Beyond those lonely hillsides lies Yorkshire. For a Lancashire lad, it's a slightly troubling prospect. There are ominous clouds over Saddleworth Moor. It's where I'm headed next. It's dark up there. The rivalry between Lancashire and Yorkshire is not like the rivalry between, say, Arsenal and Spurs. It's not merely a petty neighbourly dispute over overhanging Le Landai or a childish piece of civic grandstanding. The Lancashire-Yorkshire vendetta has its roots in a war. A proper war. With armies and battles and pikestaffs and axes. 40 years of bloodshed and mayhem. The country was plunged into anarchy from the walls of London to the bridges of Berwick-upon-Tweed. It prompted our greatest writer, old Willie Waggledagger himself, as my English teacher used to rather racially call him, to write in King Henry VI, Part 1, "And here I prophesy, this brawl today shall send between the red rose and the white 1,000 souls to death and deadly night." In these quieter days, Lancashire and Yorkshire rub up against each other uneasily and awkwardly, like big, jealous, brawling North Country brothers. They sulk and sneer at each other across the wildest, most romantic countryside in England, and they bridle when the boundaries shift and one of them loses a village or a river to the other. We each nurture deeply held prejudices against one another. They think we are soft and a bit silly, easily led and somehow lightweight. We think they are humourless and mean-spirited, arrogant and dull. Compared to us Lancastrian bon vivant, we say, waving our pints for emphasis, they are suspicious and cold, at which they slam down their tankards and declare that they are simply shrewd, self-reliant and nobody's fools. They storm out in a huff and a harumph and we realise that they never bought a bloody round. Typical. Let's be honest. Many of these traits and impressions, tykes themselves, seem only too keen to cultivate. These are a race, after all, who say of themselves with apparent pride, "Yorkshire born, Yorkshire bred, thick in the arm and thick in the head." I like to think of myself as a man of the world, a cosmopolitan freethinker unshackled by petty prejudice. I like to think of myself as this, much as I like to think of myself as a skilled and breathtaking lover, an unsung songwriting genius and the best attacking midfielder England never had. In fact, I know that I nurture some awful prejudices. Should the personal defects of anyone from a rogues gallery of Britain's most appalling individuals be mentioned, from Sir Bernard Ingham to Jeremy Clarkson, Jimmy Savile to Peter Sutcliffe, Paul Daniels to Geoffrey Boycott to Peter Stringfellow, I simply shrug and say, "Yorkshireman," in the belief that this will explain everything. But what are these churls set against Jarvis Cocker, Alan Bennett, Ted Hughes, Simon Armitage, Paul Heaton, Mick Ronson, and the other sons of York who I love and admire? Maybe these are the few dozen exceptions that prove the rule. For better or worse, and I have to say it's the latter, Yorkshire has become emblematic, axiomatic, symptomatic of the North in the hearts and minds of the South. It speaks of bullishness, lack of sophistication, dour self-sufficiency. The words that spring to mind are bluff and no-nonsense. And that is a myth. Billy Lyer, Peter Tinniswood, Penny Lane, Morrissey, the Happy Mondays, Alan Garner, Wordsworth. The North is a land of dreamers. I'm not saying it's all Yorkshire's fault, but Yorkshire has built a cottage industry. It's a little cottage on Edgett Dales, no fancy, but it's grand, lad, on singing its own praises in a queer, backhanded way. From Gervais Finn and his wholesome homilies of Dales schools, to Bernard Ingham's canonical claptrap about the Yorkshire spirit, to Roy Hattersley's florid reminiscences, Yorkshire is happiest when talking about Yorkshire, using plain language and speaking as defined. What some might call meanness, they call being careful. They enshrine these values in folklore about themselves, like the Yorkshire prayer. Hear all, see all, say nout. Eat all, drink all, pay nout. And if I ever does out for nout, allus do it for this end. Yorkshire's capacity for contrived curmudgeonly bluff has even been caricatured by Yorkshiremen themselves. In John Brain's Room at the Top, he writes of the hero's hometown thus. Bluntness was the fashion. Everyone behaved as if they were under contract to live up to the tradition of the